61 in Hyannis.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1970s, when our guest tonight, Manshia Diawara, was a teenager in his homeland of Mali, he would pray to Allah every night to help him get out of Africa, to study in Europe and live happily until at least the age of 50. Diawara got out of Africa. He, like many of his family and friends in Mali, were drawn first to France, the textbook beacon of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Later, he would be drawn on to America, land of freedom, opportunity, and rock and roll. But Manshia Diawara, like many emigres of his continent, found that being an African abroad came at a high price, psychologically and practically. Constant police checks, casual cruelty, broken dreams, and always the haunting, mocking call of Africa itself. Manshia Diawara became a successful filmmaker, respected scholar, and author, but many of his emigre brethren from Mali did not fare so well. Now Manshia Diawara is sharing, intimately, the unique experience of the African abroad, the eternal exile. Listen to this sojourner and ask yourself, is there a uniquely African view of the world, a unique worldview of Africans? Can you put yourself in Manshia Diawara's African shoes? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from a studio in New York City is Manshia Diawara, writer, filmmaker, and director of the Africana Studies Program in the Institute of African American Affairs at New York University. Manshia Diawara's new book, a memoir, is called We Won't Budge, An African Exile in the World. Good evening and welcome, Manshia Diawara.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you, and thanks so much for being with us. I'm looking forward to getting inside your story tonight, but I want to ask you just right off the bat, the title of your book, We Won't Budge. Why that?
We Won't Budge is actually taken from the great Salif Keita's song, Nous Pas Bouger, which is the Malian, the West African French for We Won't Budge. And Salif wrote this song in Paris when they began sending Malians and Senegalese back home. They were gathering them, putting them on planes and sending them back home. And he wrote this song.
Back home from France.
Right.
And so this was a kind of a We Shall Overcome for Mali.
Yes, it's a very moving song, but it has a nice beat. I went to see a Salif Keita concert at Beacon Theater in New York, and he starts singing the song, and all the immigrants stood up on their chairs and start stomping their feet. And I said, that's my song. That's my book right there, after I heard that song in New York City about 5 years ago.
And Manshia Diawara, the phrase and the song both meant something for you then. We want to hear about that experience. But what is it, after all of your years in Europe and the United States, that you personally won't budge from? Is it something about Africanness? Is it meaning physically that you won't be pushed around?
Well, you know, as you had well said, I'm a professor at New York University. I have the highest awards. I'm a university professor. One would ask, why do you bother? But when you look at the African experience in the world, in France first, where we were taught that if you learn to speak French like a Frenchman, mm-hmm. a black man can become French. Mm-hmm. And we memorized by heart Jean-Paul Sartre, Victor Hugo, Flaubert, and you name it.
And this is even before you left Mali.
You have people in Mali who know all the street names in Paris before they get to Paris.
You're in the heart of French Africa there.
That's right. In the heart of French Africa, they know Paris by heart. Mm-hmm. They know Baudelaire by heart. So by the time we get to Paris, we know the music, everything about France. Mm. And we admire the history, the symbolism of the French Revolution, liberté, égalité, fraternité. And to come to America, study, get a PhD, become a professor, get all the honors, go to France, and not be able to basically pass for an individual is what sends me back to my roots all the time, whether I want or not.
Manshia Diawara, we want to hear the details of that personal story, but give us your kind of overarching observation
in your long experience now, 70s, 80s, 90s, in Europe, in the United States, what is the special place of the African out in the world, in a globalizing world, in a world where people are presumed to move and flow? What is the African's, special joy, special burden of being in that world, the African abroad?
Right. Well, it's very complex because I grew up with the French ideology of the individual. That is, the French Revolution, the Liberté Égalité, would basically liberate us from, let's say, the church, will liberate us from the monarch, will liberate us from the dictator, the despot, and make us the great individuals who will build society.
And you saw that as an ideology that pertained entirely to you as a Malian, but of the French universe.
That's right.
This was modernity. This was for you to partake in.
That's right. That's what was calling me. Mm-hmm. But I also have an experience of being a Soninke whose last name is Diawara.
This
is my ethnic group.
Mm-hmm. Within
Mali. My last name is Diawara. And, you know, we, as people romantically tell you all the time, we had several villages, and my fathers, my great-grandfathers, they ruled these villages.
So and then noble lineage there.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then we were conquered by another ethnic group already in 18th century. And then we were conquered by Muslims. We become Muslims. So leave behind all that tribalism, leave behind all that Africanity, all that animism, become a Muslim, become a modern person. Mm-hmm. And then we were conquered by French people. So by the time I was growing up, I was a good Muslim boy, a French man, and an African of the nation state, Mali. And this is the way I knew myself.
Did you also imagine yourself at that time as a citizen of the world? Was the
exactly.
world to be your oyster? You would partake in all this.
Yes. I think that's what we're getting at, the complexity of identity, because I have amassed all those different identities, mm-hmm. but I had also encountered popular culture, Black American civil rights movement, rock and roll, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles. So this is why when you ask me to say my African identity, it kind of mixes up with a lot of identities that I had growing up in the 60s in Africa.
All the world is in there.
Exactly. Yeah.
But when you stepped out of that African context, and maybe we should just look at exactly when that was, and how that went, how old were you when you left Mali and went to Paris?
I left Mali I was about 19 years old.
And
yes.
You were going to Paris to do what? Under what circumstances?
I was going to Paris romantically to go to the Sorbonne and to study and become a writer, become a big lawyer or doctor.
So describe to us you're leaving Mali, that your first days and months in Paris, and how the reality of what you eventually found there compared with your young African dream.
Yes, when you leave Mali or when you leave Senegal or Guinea or Ivory Coast, the former French colonies, first you have a big party and you play all the great songs from rhythm and blues, rock and roll, to the Johnny Hallydays, the Sylvie Vartan, the Charles Aznavour. You know, you say goodbye to your girlfriend and you go to Paris. But as you go to Paris on the plane, you really see yourself finally like Senghor, Léopold Sédar Senghor, the first president of Senegal, who went to Paris to teach French people how to speak French.
Mm. He's going
so this
places.
Is the kind of dream that you go with.
Yeah.
And particularly, I went to Paris. I was very young. I went to Paris so that maybe I'll see Bob Dylan at the Olympia, which is the equivalent of RFK Stadium.
You were all revved up and ready to go.
That's right. I wanted to be part of the world youth movement. I wanted to see the great musicians. My dreams were not that serious. I didn't want to go teach French people how to speak French. I wanted to go to France to be part of all the youth of the world.
And your experience when you got there as the young African abroad?
I was quickly caught up in a routine. I had to find a job. First, I was in a what they call foyer, in a hostel, and all the people from my ethnic group brought presents. They all brought like equivalent of $5, mm-hmm. American dollars.
To get you lodged. So
yes. They say, okay, this is to help you on the way. And they put me in an apartment with everybody else. But a month later, I rented my own apartment at Boulevard Saint-Germain. So I left my culture, my African culture behind me.
You spent about 2 years in France then. Did France,
right.
the great beacon, did it deliver on its promise for you, Manchidiwara?
No, because I was working. I was doing what they call in France, boulot métro dodo. You know, you go to sleep, you wake up, you take the subway, you go to work, and you come back, you go to sleep again. And then I pretended to be a student. I was going to Sorbonne. I had a student ID, and it allowed me to have access to a lot of discounts, but I was not really studying seriously.
But Manchidiwara, what you're describing there, you come to the new country, you work, you sleep, you work. This sounds like the experience of millions of immigrants from all continents over the years. Was there something uniquely African in your experience of Paris, of France?
No. Well, there was something uniquely African in a sense that all the people from my area, from Francophone Africa, know France. They all go to France. You know, when you leave Africa, you have to go to France. We did not know the United States in a sense. My experience was unique because I rebelled against that situation. I still lived in the dreams that I had in Mali. I didn't see myself going to work, coming back, going to sleep, taking the subway. I saw myself as a person who, you know, was at the avant-garde, who was hip, who listened to Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, and I was not going to do the manual work. Or if I did it, it was to get the price of a ticket and go to America.
So I'm trying to figure out, did you feel then abused or singled out that you couldn't have that life? Or were you a kind of immigrant elitist who wouldn't step on to the standard immigrant experience? What was it?
I was very melancholy. I was, you know, like Byron's character. I was romantic. I just thought that this is not me. You know, there has, you know, like the Bob Dylan song, you know, there has to be somewhere out of here. So I was elitist maybe in that sense, not because I come from I come from a business family. It was not. But I just had a romantic sense of myself. I was a romantic figure. And I started going to Shakespearean Company in Paris and started meeting African-Americans. The Vietnam War was on. There was a love-hate relation with America in France. And I just wanted to be... I was in France, but I was no longer there. It was like when I was in Mali, I was thinking about France. So I was no longer in Mali. But once in France, I was there, but I was not there. I was always seeing myself in America.
America called on. And did the French deliver on their promise with your perfect French to treat you as a full man?
No. I was at high school level, and I couldn't get a real job. So I was just loading trucks, and I worked in a factory. And I began to get a sense of myself as an African, as somebody who was different. And as I said, I was very romantic, and that bothered me a lot.
I think African-Americans have often looked to France as a place, certainly African-American artists, as a place where they could get a degree of respect that they didn't find in the United States. Did you find that distinction?
When I was in Paris, I had a lot of admiration for African-Americans. I had a lot of admiration for the Afro hair that they had. They were powerful. They were black power. They were poets. French people respected them, unlike us Africans.
So, Manchidiwara, hold the thought right there. We've got to take a short break. We'll come back. We're talking this hour with writer Manchidiwara, a man from Mali, about what it means to be an African in the world. Can you put yourself in the shoes of Manchidiwara, of an African in the big world today? What is the African's burden in the world? What is the African's gift to the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Think a bid for the news.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with writer Manche Diawara, a man from Mali, about what it means to be an African in the world. He came out of Mali as a young man. He's now, many years later, director of the Africana Studies Program at the Institute of African American Affairs at New York University and author of a new memoir, We Won't Budge, An African Exile in the World. You can join the conversation as well. Africans, what's your experience of life away from that great continent? Is this a unique immigrant experience or the universal immigrant experience? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Manche Diawara, your generation is not the last generation of African immigrants. You have a passage in the book I wonder if you'd read for us where you describe a conversation or an exchange with your cousin, your cousin's son. You'll pronounce it for us, but he was born and raised in Paris, and your difference of perspective. Set this up for us and give us a bit of a read, if you would.
Yes. Tom, I'm usually a slow person. When I was in Paris, as I said to you, I was very romantic. There were lots of things happening. I was unhappy with my own situation, but I did not put it into a racial context. I also did not have access to that kind of language in the first place, mm-hmm. because in France, because of the universalist tendency, it's not cool to talk about race. To talk about Africans. We talk about colonialism, we talk about imperialism, but we never talk about race.
But your cousin's son?
It's difficult even for my cousin's son, who is African-French, to talk about race. It's only when I came to the United States, mm-hmm. 25 years later, I go to France at a very prestigious place called Collège de France, which is the main higher education institute in France, mm-hmm. to study with a man called Pierre Bourdieu, that I began to look at myself retrospectively, I'm sorry, and then to also look at African immigrants around me. And I was shocked when I talked to my cousin, because people in France still do not see race there still.
Manche
Diawara, had a struggle.
Let us hear this right from your book. We won't budge. You can read on page 62.
So I'm talking to my, I'm talking about my nephew Komakan, the son of Bintou Diawara, who's my cousin. Consider the example of my cousin Bintou's son Komakan, born and raised in Paris and 25 years old in 2000. A philosophy student at the Sorbonne, he stays at the apartment with my son whenever I'm traveling. During our brief encounters to exchange keys, we often discuss philosophy and why there are no black philosophers like Martin Heidegger or Hegel. When I ask him if he knows the Negritude movement, Frantz Fanon, Cheikh Anta Diop, and Amadou Ampateba, he answers that he is talking about real philosophers and that it has often bothered him that African civilizations had not produced great thinkers like Hegel. I know that my nephew is... So one day, when I asked Komakan what he thought about the police stopping a black man in the streets to check his identification, he shrugged his shoulders and said, "I do not let it bother me. I just let it go." "But why do you let it go without protesting?" I asked. "You were born here, and you are French like everyone else. Why do you let them treat you like that? It's racist." As I said, "I do not let it bother me. My parents raised me with a strong moral character, and that's what helped me survive. I've known discrimination since I was young and growing up in the suburbs. The teachers put you with other kids who are Arabs or black because they don't think you're smart enough. All of us end up in technical schools where we learn manual labor or drop out. After high school, I went to a school to learn how to be a cashier in supermarkets. I didn't like it, so I worked twice as hard to pass the entrance exam for the university. I'm the only black in my philosophy class. All the black students I see on campus are foreign students who do not get along because they believe that the black born here in France think they're French, and that we're lazy. Me and my Arab friends, we always get stopped by the police. One day we were coming from a party. My girlfriend was driving. Two policemen pulled us over to the side of this highway. They asked for our papers, checked our pockets, and looked in the trunk of the car for drugs. One of them just looked in my eyes and said, "If you don't like it, go home." I didn't say anything because I know myself. I know I had a stronger moral character than he did. It's not that I don't understand my rights or that I don't think it's wrong for the police to single out Arabs and blacks. It's just that I don't want any trouble with them, so I rise above them. I exercise in Kant's word a critique of pure reason. But, I remonstrated, if you do not protest, nothing will change for you or your children. Uncle, he replied, looking me in the eye, I believe that black people have to work twice as hard to get what they want. That's the only thing that is going to change our image here. That's how it is, and no one is going to change things for us. We are newcomers, and we have to pay the price. I'm going to do everything to get my diploma in philosophy and do my doctorate. That's how it is. I have to do it by myself. In America, they give black people degrees and jobs for which they're not qualified. I don't believe in that because I think that quotas are a form of racism. I'd rather work twice as hard as white people to earn my degrees. Here, you do not get anything because you're black. You have to prove that you're a man and deserve your place in society.
Mansa Diawara, originally from Mali, now in New York, reading from his new memoir, We Won't Budge, An African Exile in the World. On the African immigrant experience, you can join the conversation. Is there a uniquely African view of the world, a unique worldview of Africans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Willa's calling from Norwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Willa. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
This is such a great topic. And I can absolutely identify, even though I came to the United States in 1977 from Liberia.
From Liberia, yep.
Right. And for us, the United States is like what France is for the French-speaking African.
Mm-hmm.
It is a special burden being an African in America because I have this all these personalities. I have this American personality. And then I have an African personality. But then, too, you have an African-American personality.
Do you, Willa, as an immigrant from Africa, have an African-American personality, or is that not within your range of personality?
Well, it's something that I had to cultivate, because even though I'm black, and Americans see me as black, so they automatically assume because you're black, your culture is African-American, and it's not. So that was a very difficult thing for me, because even though I'm black and even though I'm quite aware of the African-American experience, I'm not African-American by culture.
Willa, hang with us here for a moment. Mansa Diawara, I want to get your response first to this notion, Willa's, I guess immigrants from many countries would have it, of after some years of feeling multiple personalities. Do you have the same sense
right.
of yourself as an American, as a Francophile, as an African all at once?
Absolutely. This is what I was alluding to when I said that I'm a Jawara, I'm a Muslim, and then I become colonized by French people, and then the nation state made me a Malian, and then I become French and American. But I don't see it as a burden. I see it as an asset, actually.
Well, it makes me a very interesting and exciting person.
Right.
I enjoy my multi, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
and I think it makes you a very interesting person. The only other point I would like to make is about when it comes to race and being African in America. In America, the burden of explaining your African self. Every time anybody engages you to have a conversation,
mm-hmm.
they will never have a conversation with you about things in Africa. And I know that most Americans, and no offense, are not really well-versed on Africa.
And probably quite ready to let you know so.
Right. So, but most of the conversation will be either they want to talk to you either about war or poverty or famine. And I guess the one thing that I don't get tired explaining that even though I'm from Africa, I didn't come from a poor family. I came from a well-to-do, educated, upper middle-class family. So the African experience in America, or most places, people automatically assume you must be here from a poverty-stricken background.
Willa, let me ask you something else. Mancha Diawara has his wonderful French accent within his wonderful English. You pretty much come around to an American accent yourself.
I have.
Are you perceived as African-American, as in ethnically African, but born in America, perhaps after many generations in America? How are you perceived? And do you go out of your way to point out to people that you are, in fact, an African immigrant, or does it not matter to you at this point?
I think people find that out immediately, because I'm surprised, because I've lived here since 1977. But my persona, your body language, and it is. And I know other Africans immediately when I see them. We walk differently. Our body language is different. And the way you carry yourself is different. And an American is freer with their actions and their movements. Mm-hmm. So even though I've lived here, but I still have family at home, and I have close ties to home. So when I'm with Liberians, I go very much into my Liberian accent. And when I'm working, and because I work with customers, I learned to speak in the American jargon.
Willa, it sounds like you're darn good at the whole thing. But we thank you for your observations and for sharing that. Thanks very much for your call. Mancha Diawara, what do you hear in Willa's experience and her comments?
Well, I think she's quite right that we share many identity issues. Liberia has a unique experience in Anglophone Africa.
And a unique long-term relationship with the United States.
With the United States, let's say compared to Ghana or Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it's similar to the Francophone's relation to France. I enjoyed listening to her.
And what about your experience, Mancha Diawara, as a Francophone African, but now in America for a long time? Have you begun at all to self-identify as African-American, or is that a category that you don't belong to somehow?
Well, you see, for me, I'm going to turn 50. When I came to the United States, I was in Washington, D.C., a place that they used to call Chocolate City in the 70s. I came exactly in 1974, and I was given addresses to visit people in D.C. from Paris. A friend of mine, Ted Jones, actually, who just passed away, introduced me to African-American culture. Also, as I said, in the 60s.
Ted Jones, the poet.
Right, Ted Jones, the poet. And so I actually thought I had passed completely for an African-American in Washington, D.C. in those days, for black, basically, black American. And it's only now that I begin to recognize my accent, know that I'm not, you know, fluently speaking black American English. So it's the other way around for me. Mm-hmm. When I first came up, I was fighting very hard to pass for a black American for a long time. And now, as I grow old, my son, every once in a while, I question some of my pronunciations. What did he say, Dad? And then he would laugh at me, and then I realize I have an African accent.
And you don't mind?
No.
And neither do we. Siddiqui is calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Siddiqui. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Real well, thanks.
Good. This is a very interesting conversation. And hello?
Yes, we're right here. We're all ears.
Yeah, I've been listening to your calls and your guests, and I guess I'm really interested in regards to response from your guests as it pertains to what I consider to be the African experience, if you will, because I'm interested in terms of the whole aspect of the issue of white supremacy, you know, in terms of France having been a colonial power.
Yes, sure.
And indoctrinating Africans into thinking that you're better off someplace else and being French or going to the United States, what have you, mm-hmm. because of the fact that, you know, my ancestors came here as slaves from the continent of Africa.
Not voluntarily.
Exactly. And so the thing, I guess, that I find somewhat disturbing is, like, when I heard the sister from Liberia talking about being African-American, being mm-hmm. American, mm-hmm. I mean, the bottom line is that we're all Africans living here in the United States, here for various reasons, a lot of them not very nice. And so,
Siddiqui, are you saying, if I may, are you expressing disappointment in Mansa Diawara and other African immigrants that they voluntarily left Africa?
Well, I would say that first and foremost, so let me say this, I think in the 21st century that the continent of Africa is going to be the key piece of land in the world for the survival of this planet. But and we need our folks there. I guess for me is when I hear us emphasizing our differences, when I hear the brother saying he was trying to pass as a quote-unquote black American, or the sister saying that she's part American, she's Liberian with the Liberians, but then she's sees herself as being part African-American. See, we always emphasize these differences. I know that in the context of the people that I'm around, and I see young people now, that there's not a lot of differentiation, if you will, in terms of sharing the experiences and separation, if you will, that went along with, say, my generation. I'm in my 50s.
So, Siddiqui, let me get Mancha's response, because we're coming toward a break here, and I don't want to run out of time. It's an interesting issue. I guess two things there, Mansa Diawara. Number one, to a certain extent, Siddiqui is calling you on having left Mali in the first place, and at some level saying, hey, you had a great home continent. Why didn't you stay and live in that context and you know, grab onto that? And secondly, he makes the point that, and I guess it's origin-based, it's race-based somehow, that all Africans are Africans, wherever they are, whatever their national circumstances.
Right.
Do you agree?
Well, you know, when I came to this country, and I'm going to address the second question first, the nomenclature was black American. We didn't have the term African American then. And the term African American, which is a powerful term and which I completely subscribe to, kind of render almost invisible the powerful contribution of black American to the liberation of Africa, to the liberation of South Africa, to the civil rights struggle in this country.
So why would it render that invisible? It would seem to me to make that link.
Because when you suddenly say we all Africans, both African American and their Africans of this country, you are right. But it's as if the search for that name, we all African, is going to disguise the struggle that took place in this country that's independent from Africa. And beside that, when you think the term Africa itself is a modern term, it's Europeans and Americans who begin to call us African.
So you're saying history itself has drawn distinctions.
Yeah, we don't know ourselves as Africans. We are Malian, Senegalese. I mean, through modernity, of course, we do know everybody. We all call ourselves African, but it's a term that's imposed. So to only hold on to that, which is fine, I think we forget the struggle of the civil rights. This is what I'm trying to say.
And the differences that lie therein. Siddiqui, we're not going to forget the second part of your question. Thanks for calling. We're talking tonight with writer Mansa Diawara, a man from Mali, about what it means to be an African in the world. Can you put yourself in the shoes of Mansa Diawara, of an African in the big world today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
8-7.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with writer Mansa Diawara, a man from Mali, about what it means to be an African in the world. His new memoir is We Won't Budge, An African Exile in the World. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Mansa Diawara, we had the question just before the break there from a caller saying, hey, brother, Africa's a great place. All folks of African origin should know that. Why didn't you stay?
Right. I mean, the same question was asked me in 1976 by Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture, Ture, that you know very well, of the Black Power movement.
Sure.
I met him in Washington, D.C. I said, hey, brother, you my hero. I come to work with your struggle. He said, go back to Guinea, man. That's where the struggle is. And incidentally, I was just making a film in Conakry recently. I talked to the wife of Stokely Carmichael, and she said she had the same struggle with Stokely, who didn't want her to send their son to study in America because, you know, this place is the devil. This is the snake. Why send your son to study here?
So how did that hit you as the African immigrant? Did it knock the wind out of you? Did it take the wind out of your sails? Or
no. Well, because I was completely disappointed. It's like, well, first, let me answer this quickly.
You know,
the Siddiq said himself that, you know, we have neocolonialism, we brainwashed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you stay in Africa, you probably will stay in that neocolonialism and that brainwashing. You need education. And I basically came to get education in the place where they have the best education now.
To get a little vantage on that.
Right, yeah. And then what we do for Africa today is what's probably more important than staying in Africa because it's Africa. But it also, you know, the whole idea of Africa is very confusing because when I was in Washington, D.C., I received, my uncle in the book. I talk about my uncle in the book. Well, I was very confused. African Americans wanted me to study Africa, to know my roots. I was from princes and kings and, mm-hmm. and so on. And then I wrote a letter to my uncle and said to him, you know, uncle, I have just discovered myself. Our name is in Du Bois, The World in Africa book. And this is so wonderful. And, you know, I mean, if you want, I can read that letter to you in the book.
I think we may be short of time to read that, Mancha, and we've got more callers who want to come in. Let me take them. Steve's calling from North Kingston, Rhode Island. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Actually, I want to comment on three very specific points. One is your guest, there is some kind of generalization about African experience. I think Africa is a vast continent, and there is no such thing as generalization of Africa.
Steve, are you from Africa yourself?
Yeah, I am from Ethiopia.
From Ethiopia, all right. So, of course, it is a huge continent. We grant you that.
And basically what happened is African experience you guys are trying to generalize depends the way the individual has come here. For example, some people come for school, some people come forced due to war or some unfortunate situations.
Some are refugees, you're saying? Yeah, okay.
And so based on that, the acceptance of the culture or the experience depends also mainly where you arrive, how the community accepts you, and what the other influences.
So, Steve, are you saying that then there's no common thread in the experience of African immigrants to the United States?
No. I think that is a very mistaken idea.
Our time is running down, so let me take it right there, Steve, but I appreciate it. Mancha Diawara, what's your reply?
Well, I think that he's very right. Africa is a vast continent, and also we come here for different reasons. I was a young boy in the 70s. I wanted to leave France. I was dreaming. I was romantic, and I come with one experience. So I completely agree with the caller. I agree.
Not one common story. You write touchingly in your book, Mancha, about Amadou Diallo, of course, who was a young African who was killed by New York City police in 1999. And you describe him and others like him as what you call homeboy cosmopolitans, a group who very much looked the part of African Americans, but in other ways were very different. What do you mean by that?
Well, when we come here, we dress like African Americans. This is common to all of us, by the way. We live in African American communities in the United States, and then we go to work and we come back home. And largely, we choose to stay apart from that African American culture and community. We do not learn what is inside.
So you dress that way, you're saying. I'm not so sure Steve would agree, but you dress that way, but you don't really integrate with that community, you're saying.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mostly we do not integrate the community, but America also sees us as black. Very few Americans will see an African coming and say this is an African. They see you as black. And my argument is perhaps we need to learn more about the African-American community here and benefit from some of the strategies that African-Americans have learned in this country.
You actually say that Amadou Diallo's death prompted you to write your memoir. Why?
Well, because I came here, as I said, very romantic and It was one of the wake-up calls for me. There are a lot of young people coming here now. They're no longer going to France. France, Europe as a whole, through Schengen Treaty, has closed the door to Africans. Mm-hmm. The only Africans who can go to Europe are those who basically go through the channel in Spain and sneak into France illegally and sweep the streets, low wages. So now, everybody come to America not only because America supposedly won the Cold War. America is the big empire now. We all come here, but we do not understand this country. So I'm hoping that my book will contribute to that understanding of this country.
Masha Dewar, it's been a fascinating hour, and I want to thank you for joining us. It's been great having you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mancha Diawara is director of the Africana Studies Program in the Institute of African American Affairs at New York University. Originally from Mali, he's author of the new memoir, We Won't Budge, An African Exile in the World. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, breaking down two of today's buzzwords. This is On Point. Hot words and phrases come and go. While they're with us, they frame our thinking, our politics, our personal interactions, our outlook. We thought we'd look at the buzz and origin of a couple of hot words tonight with veteran word watcher Barbara Walraff. She's author of the best-selling Word Court and words columnist for the Atlantic Monthly. Welcome, Barbara Walraff.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Barbara, you've got a couple of words that friends of yours have raised recently saying, what about that? We've got one on the line right now. Grenville, hello, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Grenville, thanks for joining us. What's your word?
Roadmap.
Roadmap. It's everywhere. It's in the air. We can't get away from roadmaps these days. And what question does roadmap raise for you, Grenville?
Well, I think two. One, what is a roadmap? If it's a map with roads on it, it doesn't seem to me it's going to be much use. What you need is a route. And the second, of course, if that wasn't bad enough, is the metaphors that spring from it. We learn, for example, that Ariel Sharon has embraced the roadmap. Now, I don't know about you. Whenever I embrace a map, it turns crinkly and useless. Maybe that's what they mean.
All right. So we've got the roadmap to Middle East peace, and Grenville doesn't like the word. Where does this come from? Why roadmap, Barbara? And what about it? Does it work?
Roadmap is really interesting because it is kind of a word that named itself. It's been lurking around in public policy circles for just under a year, and it pertains to a speech that President Bush gave late last June in the Rose Garden. Mm-hmm. He did not use the words roadmap, but almost immediately people in the media, Senator Henry Hyde, started arguing about whether what Bush had said would serve as a roadmap for peace or not. And that phrase has continued to be associated with this new stage of the peace process.
Does it matter in politics and international relations whether we've got a grammatically ideal formulation here or not?
I think it does make for some awfully strange thoughts. It almost makes it harder to think about what's going on. The accords that have been named are things like the Camp David Accords or the Oslo Accords. And there you know what you're talking about, and it's easy to use those things in a sentence. But I, too, have been finding examples in the press, well, from a story that was published in the Christian Science Monitor earlier this week, a U.S.-driven roadmap.
We see American cars driving on a map.
Or an AP story also this week, Likud lawmakers charged that the roadmap was slanted in favor of the Palestinians.
Grenville, give us an alternative handle for President Bush and Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas to bandy around when they get together.
A plan, perhaps?
Oh, but it just doesn't have
strategy.
Any snap to it.
Well, the truth is that what we're talking about is the Rose Garden ultimatum, and I can understand why nobody wants to call it that.
the Rose Garden ultimatum, you will walk this way, you will go this way.
That's kind of where this started, and I can see why they didn't want to associate it with the Rose Garden, as is typical of these things where you say the Camp David Accords, the Oslo Accords, and you certainly don't want to say something like ultimatum, which is basically what it was.
Right, forget it. Barbara, we've got another friend, another word. Hatsy, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I'm hearing a word from my wonderfully chic New York daughters-in-law and wondering really what this word snarky means.
Ooh, snarky.
Snarky. One of them is an editor magazine in New York,
yeah.
And a earnest, wonderful piece comes in, wholesome and wide-eyed, and the editors sit around and look at each other and say, this needs to be more snarky. What are they saying?
Barbara Woolraff.
This is interesting to hear snarky used as a positive quality.
In New York editing circles, some pretty sharp circles.
Well, Hatsy, did you know that just a week or two ago, there was a piece in the New York Observer, which is very much New York editing circles, as a riposte to a woman named Heidi Julewicz, who is a co-editor of a new magazine called The Believer.
Uh-huh.
Heidi was complaining about a certain tone adopted by reviewers, and she said, I call it snark, and it has crept with alarming speed into the reviewing community, infiltrating the pages of many publications. Most frightening is how easily snark is perpetrated by snark bites.
And what is snark? Snarky to snark.
A knowing tone. Hatsy, does that sound about right to you? Sort of, if you want to think of it as pejorative, you'd call it smarty pants or smart aleck.
Right, or real attitude or sass, maybe.
I've heard the adjective more often, snarky, and meaning someone who tilts negative in a sharp, pejorative way. But here you're talking about them wanting more snark, more sort of bristly attitude.
Yeah.
And I've heard literary agents also saying, well, this character is snarky and it lends a little edge to the book, that kind of thing.
Is there a suggestion there as well, Hatsy, of insincerity or something manipulative?
I'm not sure that that's the way Leela used it at her magazine.
Yeah.
It was more someone in the know. And I'm right sitting here at my kitchen table sort of wiggling my shoulders. It's kind of, or if I could get my hips into it, it would just mean sass.
And origins, isn't there a Lewis Carroll connection here?
He invented snark, and I think he invented snark just as something that was pretty easy to rhyme with. It rhymes with a mark and dark and hark and so on. But there was an older word that comes from Dutch or German verb, snark, that is either an animal sound, sort of like snort or snort.
Yeah.
Snarking would be to make pig-type noises or also to nag or complain. So this is a word that has a long history.
The bottom line, as I hear it, Hatsy, snarky is not something you're aspiring to just yet.
I don't want to snark, but I might not mind being a little snarkier myself.
Just stylishly snarky.
Okay.
Hatsy, thanks so much. Thanks for snarky. And Bubba Rolref, what a great exploration. We're down the roadmap. We haven't been too snarky. I hope just snarky enough to be cool.
We'll find out.
Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Barbara Woolraff is author of the best-selling Word Court and Words columnist for the Atlantic Monthly. Thanks for being with us, Barbara.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.